This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on her vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. In 1964, seeking to develop an antenna to measure various forms of radiation clearly and precisely, physicists Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias kept getting some interference, like poor reception in your stereo system, a hiss, a hum. The scientists at first feared the noise would interfere with their experiment, but in fact, the hiss was generated by photons left over from the moment the universe began, 12 to 16 billion years ago. The sounds they heard were radio fossils from the Big Bang. This discovery of what is now known as cosmic blackbody radiation helped confirm the Big Bang theory, and Wilson and Penzias received the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1978 for their work. Arno Penzias is my guest today. He's currently Vice President of Research at the AT&T Bell Labs in New Jersey, where he helps guide other scientists in the creation and effective use of information technology in our society. His new book, Ideas and Information, Managing in a High-Tech World, covers the evolution of computers, the mathematical operations underlying numerical processing, and the major differences between human and machine intelligence. In a New York Times book review, Timothy Bay wrote that Penzias has the shirt-sleeves practicality of the manager combined with the scientist insider's familiarity with technology. I asked Arno Penzias how he encourages people at Bell Labs to innovate.
Well, I hope your listeners will take an honest answer. I work very hard on small rewards for good behavior. I can't tell people in advance how to innovate. All I can do is tell them when I like something, when I respond positively. And words are cheap, so I try little tokens. I give out books, T-shirts, chocolate bars, nice 400-gram. And in fact, sometimes I even give out the 5-kilogram chocolate bars in case it's a team effort. And I think that that the notion of rewarding good behavior is probably the best way of leading any human enterprise.
I mean, it makes you sound like, in many ways, kind of like Rodney Dangerfield in Back to School, you know, passing out the pens in the classroom to his colleagues. You know, sort of a salesman impressing the clients.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I mean, human institutions have, after all, are all organized around human beings. And I don't think scientists are all that different. You do try to avoid censorship. You try to act as a role model, I know I do, by not worrying terribly much about making mistakes and about being willing to stick my neck out, make an estimate, come up with something which might be wrong and try to fix it later. I don't wait until I have every possible fact at my fingertips before I venture an opinion. I do label it as an opinion. I do label it as a tentative first thrust. But I think that's another way of innovating, which is to just start out, do something, try it, and see how it works.
It sounds like you encourage the idea of failure in the research and development labs.
Absolutely. I think if we don't have failure, if we're doing everything, if we only do things which are guaranteed to succeed, we're not doing our job. Just by definition, if we're going out and looking at the unknown, some fraction of those things have to fail. Otherwise, the amount of new knowledge you can gather is pretty small. One of the troubles with history books, especially the history of science, is it's almost always written in the way that the scientist would have liked to behave rather than the way it really went. All the kinds of mistakes people make, people feel guilty about and then try to hide them later from themselves and from others. And so what ultimately comes out is the a clear line of the steps of going from A to B to C to D, and all the little detours, almost all of them, are left out. I think that's what I liked about the Double Helix, a book written by Jim Watson some years ago, where some of the blunders and side issues came out in his day-to-day story of how he worked on the first modeling of DNA. Human research and all in human inquiry is an iterative process, and it's fraught with dead ends. The trouble is that most of us feel a little ashamed, or maybe the word is fraudulent. We all feel that people around us overrate us, you know, that we are not quite as smart as people think we are, and we just have to kind of hide, not ask too many questions, and not betray our ignorance, so otherwise people won't find out how much dumber we are than all the people around us. And that tendency, which I find pervasive among smart people everywhere, is one that we really have to fight in a research lab. I suspect in other walks of life you have to also, in order to get people to be willing to be upfront about the mistakes they make. So they're willing to tackle something, even if they're going to be proven wrong.
A lot of scientific discoveries seem to come out of very poorly equipped labs, inexpensive equipment. Major scientific corporations like Hewlett-Packard start in garages. How important is sort of the crude beginnings for some of these discoveries?
I think the crude beginnings are very important because, after all, every idea, however great and complex, I believe, begins between one pair of human ears. And the person who's starting that work almost always begins in a small single person or small team environment. And when we look at the really important discoveries of the past century, very few of them have been made with the biggest piece of equipment available. It's often the second or third biggest telescope that finds the galaxy rather than the biggest one. An accelerator that got to be used on a more speculative project than the top of the line model, which you have to wait years to get time on. That is something to do with the nature of discovery. Discovery is a private, I think, to a great degree, discovery is a private activity. And as private individuals, an environment which works on a human scale is often the most productive. That's not to say we don't need big machines, we don't need large and complex teams for some things, but the human spark that begins most progress starts usually on a very small scale. And much of what is ultimately discovered is often done in small groups.
You've written and talked about the idea of the invisible college, the idea of colleagues, other physicists that you can sort of get on the phone and talk over ideas with. And in fact, your ideas about the background noise of the universe fit into somebody else's concept of a cosmology, which eventually led to understanding the Big Bang Theory, all through sort of a series of phone calls. It seems to me that science works best when it's kept open rather than secret and private in laboratories.
I think that's quite true, and I think that one of the things you find all over the world, and I think even in the countries where economies and other discipline tried to be kept in a closed environment, have found that unless one keeps this world scientific openness, unless you pay your membership dues, you're not going to be part of the club. And it's kind of paradoxical, isn't it? I spoke a moment ago of science being based on individuals, loners sitting there getting an idea. But in order to refine those ideas, it takes access to other people. And that's also done on a one-on-one basis very often, but it gets socialized over a much larger group of people because there aren't all that many experts in the world, and science is highly compartmentalized because there's so much to know, and any one person can only keep a small part of it in mind at any one time.
Early on, when you were first studying science in school and going to the Brooklyn Technical School,
I believe it was Brooklyn Technical High School,
yeah.
Right.
You noticed that there wasn't as much of a cultural bias there in the world of science. And I'm wondering if you still feel that science is a field that's fairly free of cultural bias.
I think there is less cultural bias in science than most other fields. This is why you find so many recent immigrants coming in, especially our Asian immigrants coming in large numbers into science, because you don't have to, as I didn't when I first came to America, you don't have to be able to speak English perfectly. You didn't have to go to the right school and be able to have all the right set of credentials. Much of what your ratings depend on is really in your own control in science, which is very nice. You produce a piece of work, whether it's a program or a new kind of transistor or a new understanding of polymer structure, and the way that science works, that the credit for that belongs to you. It's very different, say, from being an interviewer. You get a job in an advertising, or you get a job somewhere in a personnel department interviewing people. Well, how do you tell who the good or the bad interviewer is? And much of it has to do, I suppose, with social skills, the way the person comes across in things which have little to do with the job itself. And science, You have a little bit more freedom to be a nerd if you want, I suppose, is one way of putting it.
My guest is Nobel Prize-winning physicist Arno Penzias. His book, Ideas and Information, has just been published in paperback. Each new technology that comes along to be a time saver or an advance seems to bring with it its own then problems. Fax machines can send messages back and forth across the country, but now people are getting junk faxes tying up their machines.
Sure. I think the point is that I think what we have to maintain is a general dissatisfaction with technology. I think that's one of the reasons I wrote Ideas and Information. It's not a compendium of look what technology can do for you, but try to give people a basic understanding of what technology does so they can build a strategy around the kinds of things they want and demand more. For example, on a fax machine, which have storage rather than one that dumps the paper out at you, one could look at a cathode ray tube and just scan which of the pages you'd really like printed and push a button and discard the others the way you do electronic mail. It's not asking for a lot more, and I suspect in a few years some fax manufacturers are going to have that feature, and then junk fax disappears because you can screen it.
What about
you? Sound surprised?
Well, no. Well, it's part of the pleasure of sort of thinking. Yeah. Well, there can be a technological solution. I've seen fax machines that will store messages without printing them out, but there's no way of seeing them yet.
And yeah, I suppose that there are faxes. Then you just call them up on your screen. Now there's several ways of doing that.
Well, I think that faxes connected with computers can do that.
You want to do. I mean, this is back to the notion of integration. I think one of the great opportunities in our society today is to start to integrate all the junk we have around our house. We have our hi-fi set. You've got a fax. You may have a PC. You've got a microwave oven, a burglar alarm, telephones of various kinds, your answering machine. Well, all those machines playing together could be much more valuable. And for example, when you get your messages on your answering machine, you might like to have them in the form of text. So if there's a text-to-speech recognition system there, which could turn the spoken messages into text, you can then scan them by name on a screen and then pick the ones you want to listen to, and you can junk the rest. It's not that we have too much information. The trick is that the information is in forms we really don't like and what we can't, and forms which we're not comfortable in dealing with. I mean, I don't think I have as much information today as I want. I have a lot of information I don't want, and to be able to sort through the two requires some information tools, and the tools I want are different from the ones other people would want. That's why no single recipe will help everybody.
How have you equipped your own home with new technologies, personal computers, cellular phones, something that maybe hasn't even reached the market?
Let me see. I guess, well, let's see. What do I have at home? No, I don't think there is a single piece of electronic. I recently bought a television set and VCR so we could watch movies at night. But in my own home, the only piece of high technology I have at all is a fax machine. We have a number of telephones. I don't have a. I did have a PC and I did have a terminal for a while, but I just don't use it enough. I find that I do much better with the electronic mail in the office, and occasionally, if I happen to be somewhere else, my secretary will just print the stuff out and fax it to me. But as far as writing is concerned, I wrote Ideas and Information with a yellow pad and a manually sharpened number 3 pencil. So I don't find I need those things. You know, we have the usual kinds of stuff like a microwave oven and so forth and ordinary automobiles, but no trickery. I do have a telephone in my car. In fact, I have 2 telephones in 2 cars because I don't ever want to be out of touch with other people. But voice contact is usually adequate, so I don't find the need for computers or things of that sort. But I made those choices, and let me just say one more thing here. I made those choices as part of a conscious sequence of acts. That is, I did this based on knowledge. Maybe you need a PhD to be able to have the authority to say, no, I don't really want a personal computer. But it's one of the things I tried to point out in my book is that everybody has the right, in fact, to the obligation themselves to work out a personal information processing strategy that fits them.
I'm interested in the way social decisions are made and butt up against the world of technology. For instance, I think many people are interested in cellular telephone technology, other forms of private communication that go on. But the spectrum of broadcast bands is being taken up in large part by television channels. And I'm wondering if you see a time when society might say, we don't need 13 VHF channels, we could get by with only 10, and we'll turn the rest over to private communication.
Well, I'd be surprised if you have to attack the... Well, actually, of the 13 channels, you only get 11 because channel 1 is off for something else, right? We all start with 2 to 13, mm-hmm. So there's only a dozen. Well, there are a dozen VHF channels, but there are many times that amount of spectrum reserved to UHF, and that's probably a place where I think our society may really want to go and look to see if that really is the best allocation of resources. As we move into a world where, the wires all over the building, we have wires all over buildings, and every time you want to move a desk, you have to go. All sorts of strange people come and get connectors and power supplies and all bits and pieces. I suspect that as we move into the future, you would be much nicer if you just have a box which you just get power for, and everything else is handled by radio waves. That would take a little more spectrum than we're using today.
Mm-hmm. When you go out to the to look at the night sky, do you feel any sort of romance about the stars, or do you examine them as a scientist who sees them in terms of molecules and radiation?
Oh, not at all. I look at them in a very romantic way. I mean, I look up there and I see Orion, that friendly giant, and I often look up there and say, boy, he was really good to me. If you look at Orion's hunting knife, and the middle star of that is actually a cloud of stars and gas and dust. And some years ago, when I worked on the study of interstellar molecules, we found a large number of molecular substances up in that region, and a lot of gas which hadn't been detectable in any other way before. And so we opened up a whole new field.
My guest is Arno Penzias. His book, Ideas and Information, is a guide to the rapidly changing new information technologies. You pointed out that knowing how to work a computer is not the same as computer literacy. And now that computers are being introduced in schools for people at very young ages, I wonder if you could explain what you see as the difference.
Yeah. Learning how to operate a computer is really rote learning of a set of instructions. If you do A or B, then C will happen. And I think it's far more important to teach children something to do with the rudiments of computation, to understand how to, and then to adults as well, to understand how to plan computation, how to plan algorithms, how to organize information. The detailed implementation on the machine is the last piece you really need. If you understand how computers work, what they can and can't do for you, somebody else can do the spreadsheet and you can look at it and you're all set.
One of the constant issues that comes up involving new technology is the hardware. It can look very pretty, it can do wonderful things, but often you have the question of what to do with it. I was interested in the beginnings of AT&T when investors were saying, sell the telephones, and somebody came along and said, no, actually what you want to do is sell the idea of connectivity, that what's actually going on is the ability to link people together.
I think what we've seen is a revolution in value. Value used to reside in things. Value today resides far more in intangibles, such as the ability to connect people together, the knowledge groups of people have on how to operate a particular system, the software, if you will, that underlies computing. All those are intangibles. They don't really, they don't really exist in the same way as people had ingots of gold or hogsheads of rum. So we've moved away from the physical into something which is more information based. I don't have a good word for it, but that's why I talked about it in stories or anecdotes rather than try to philosophize.
Mm-hmm. In the interest of passing information around, what technology are you and your researchers playing with at the labs that looks very exciting that we might not yet know about?
Well, I would think right now the things I'm most excited about today are our work in speech and images. Not that we couldn't recognize some kinds of speech in the past, and not that you can't today buy a computer which can speak to you like this. But we're getting to the point where in a few years, I suspect we will get the recognition of fluent speech. And then coupling that with some of the pattern matching things that we're going to be able to get computers to do, we will have machines which, while they have nothing, they resemble in no way the intelligent machines that people talked about a few years ago when the hype of artificial intelligence was at its height. You'll find these machines will be able to do things which even some of the artificial intelligence people didn't dare predict because it would seem too difficult. And we do it with dumb machines simply because we're able to create algorithms to do to do that kind of work.
It sounds like you must get up each day very excited about going to work.
Oh, yeah. Well, sometimes, the only trouble is sometimes I get up when it isn't even time to get up, and I look at my clock and say 2 o'clock in the morning, I start thinking about something, and then I say, well, now I better, come on, shut up and go to sleep or something. I've got to sleep now. And it's hard because there's so many exciting things. I think the loveliest thing about my job is the number of people who are excited about their work and are willing to explain things to me. So I get to learn about lots of stuff, and there is lots going on. It really is magic. It's kind of a it's kind of a miracle that I have this job. I have this opportunity to learn about all sorts of technology and share some of that knowledge with others. It's really great.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Well, glad to do it.
Arno Penzias' book, Ideas and Information, has just come out in paperback. Dr. Penzias won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1978. He's now Vice President of Research at AT&T Bell Labs. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.